Fools! Skeksis fools! What do you want with me?
This is no Gelfling!
Of course I'm no Gelfling, you putrid lizards! I'll get my eyes for you!
She was with him! She helped him! Where is he?
Gone! Gelfling gone! Stupid Gartim! You want Gelfling? Why not ask me? No! Easier to send your crab-brained soldiers!
Burn my home!
Now, home gone! Gelfling gone! Nothing but ogre! Moldy mildew, mother of mouth muck! Dangle and strangle to death!
Oh, how cruel!
Watch your tongue, Harridan! We are lords of the crystal!
Lords? Not for long! What about the prophecy? That a Gelfling will end Skeksis' power? He'll come, make you crawl like the worms you are!
Find that Gelfling now!
Episode 71 of the Cult of Matt and Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And make sure to visit our blog at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com. 71, this is our big show, 71. We didn't really celebrate 70. That was the last episode, but a bit of a benchmark. Milestone there, if you will. So
it's a good number. It's longer than I usually keep on any task. I usually give up pretty quickly after starting any endeavor.
You know, you look on the iTunes page and you see, it's like, Jesus Christ, we've produced a lot of mediocre content, you know, for the internet. So
this is a lot of hours of real sort of base level content.
Yeah, you could drive across the fucking country and listen to us inanely droning in your car stereo for pretty much the whole endeavor, which is remarkable.
It's interesting. I really, I continue to try to listen to other movie podcasts, and it's amazing how quickly I tire of some. But there's a few that I enjoy. There's something, I think it's really comes down to the personalities of the people. I sort of like it when there's a little bit of fire,
a little bit of zing,
a little bit of zap, yeah,
a little bit of sexual tension, like you and I have.
That's right. Really, that's right.
Kind of seal the deal. This week, our film is the 1982, I would call it a children's movie. I'd say it's definitely a cult classic in its own right, The Dark Crystal by Jim Henson. I saw this in the theater when I was a kid, and I actually remember parents walking out with their children at times when it got really dark and a little bit freaky. The kids would get upset. It wasn't a parental decision. And then the parents would leave with the kids. And, I mean, that was fuck all. I must have been, like, near 10, I guess, back then. So,
yeah, this movie's a little disturbing. Actually, that's a great idea. I think I might buy this for my older brother's kids. That should piss him off.
Is he really into auditing the content that his children are privy to?
Well, I think it, just as you were saying, different children have different sensitivities and material. And some of them, I mean, if something's too much action, too much tension, it can really sort of send a kid, can make a kid real nervous and anxious. So I think you just naturally censor it. I don't think it's a decision you make. I think it's just an instinct to protect your kid from something that they find disturbing.
Either that or just being a pain in the ass and having bad dreams and, you know, wanting to get into the bed like every night for a week. That would get annoying right there. So
yeah, I think there's just, I don't think it's because you're a big ninny that you're auditing what your kids see. I think there's a lot of practical concerns.
I like to just chalk it up to the fact that you're just a big ninny with a lack of depth and foresight and opinion.
Yeah, that's okay. I think your opinions will be changing before too long.
Yeah, I know. We'll see about that.
Oh, you know, I did want to mention before we get into the movie that everybody should be welcome to a very special Cult Matt and Mark Nights.
Yes, it's a night cast. I was thinking about that today.
We're usually midday, morning, or afternoons.
I know. Just another little window into the show, if people are fans, is that we're actually not anywhere near being in the same room together. We're actually about, what, 20, 25 miles apart?
Yeah, we found this is just easier than meeting in person. It's more of a pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah.
I never have anything set up to have, you know, guests over, so my place is always a disaster. And plus, it's actually the editing's easier when we're separated because there's no crosstalk between the mics. It's really easy to edit that way. The only problem is the delay can end up having us talk over each other a bit. And you see, I have some, our podcast listeners can't find it, but do you like the nice soft light that's...
I do. It reminds me like we're doing the Venus Flytrap, you know, night DJ thing from WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah. I got myself a Gone with the Wind lamp.
Nice. I got an IKEA $12 lamp illuminating me here tonight. So anyway, into the movie. Let's do the plot rundown. It's fairly straightforward, but not. It has a little bit of some metaphysical stuff going on. The titular crystal maintains equilibrium in a mythical kingdom. When the crystal is broken, the evil Skeksis take over, killing off the good guy Gelflings and enslaving everyone else. Two of the Gelflings have survived. Jen was raised by the all-knowing mystics, while Kira grew up among the swamp-dwelling podlings. Jen and Kira join forces to heal the Dark Crystal and restore order to the world. Adults may find the whole affair a little precious, while children may be disturbed by the film's mortality rate. Yeah, there's some deaths of cute, kind of cuddly things, you know.
It's really neat.
It's a PG-rated movie, for starters.
Well, and I'm sort of surprised a little bit, because you wonder what the parents, we were talking about the parents with their kids. I wonder what they are first thinking when the fifth minute, the main character, Jen, is seen bathing naked by the side of a brook.
He is, technically he's as naked as Kermit the Frog, but he does have a little bit more human quality than your average run-of-the-mill Muppet.
The Gelflings are sort of like elves, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, Gelfling is sort of, what would you call it, a knockoff term for an elf, even though it's not even trademarked, that term.
Yeah, they sort of look like a small feline-esque elf.
Yeah, they kind of look like the Na'vi.
Yeah, they do look a little bit like the Na'vi, yeah.
Not that James Cameron ever rips off any ideas for his movies, but I'm just saying, you know.
They're flesh-colored Na'vi and small.
They got those little kind of cat ears, you know.
I thought they were more like the Vulcan ears. They're sort of pointy. They're really kind of
more on the top of their head a little bit. I'm just saying, yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
So the Gelflings. And then the Podlings are kind of like proto, what were the little critters from Fraggle Rock? What were those I forget. You ever watch Fraggle Rock?
You know, I never really did watch Fraggle Rock. It reminded me a little bit of Lemmings from that video game, The Lemmings.
Yeah. Well, there was the...
They look a little bit like they're suffering from trisomy of one of their chromosomes.
Yeah. It doesn't look like a healthy state of being, the Podlings.
And their language sounds vaguely Eastern European.
Oh.
Did you notice that?
Was Jim Henson a racist? I don't know.
You know, I wonder. Know. You know, people talk about that. They talk about that in the Star Wars prequels with some of the various types of aliens where they remind people of certain racial stereotypes of humanity.
I know that the co-pilot of Lando Calrissian in Return of the Jedi, that Muppet or whatever the hell it was blasted by the media for being a caricature of the Southeast Asian individual. I don't know if you...
Oh, really? The one that sort of laughs to himself? I always saw him as more Hispanic than anything else. But you're right. Maybe he does look a little Filipino.
Little Filipino. You know, the Filipinos work everywhere, so it just kind of goes without saying that there might be a whole planet equivalent race that just works the universe like that.
That's funny, because I guess I always saw that character. I know the one you're talking about. I just always saw that character as Hispanic for some reason.
Well, you know what I say, hate mail welcome, is that Filipinos are really the Mexicans of Asia, you know, so... Take that.
Well, I mean, there's an issue with the countries had a lot of problem with corruption and
Roman Catholic, a lot of people, big families, and they work everywhere. That's
well,
I
because
got
people that. Leave the country to. Yeah, I mean, it's very apt. People leave their home country to go work in other countries to send money back home. It's pretty standard operating procedure. I think it's standard procedure for a lot of poor countries. I mean, you can think about in the Mideast, the
Filipinos there too. A lot of them.
Well, like there's like Afghanistanis and let's see,
Bangladesh. She's a lot of Bangladeshis and Pakistanis.
All right, it's just standard movement of workforces.
We're getting off topic here, but
let's go. Anyway, I want to really deep into this.
The podlings you're saying resemble sort of almost a gypsy like community there in the swamps of what's the world called? The world has a name.
Oh, I did not catch the name of the world.
What is the name of the world? Without dragging down the podcast, I can't find it. I'm sorry. What I was thinking of was when you attach the word ling to anything, like I've been watching Game of Thrones and there's the wildlings. Does ling mean that's where you're from or where you've been living? Is that kind of where the idea or that suffix comes from?
I always considered that suffix to mean small.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, a small version. So Gelfling is sort of a small Gelf.
All right, I'll buy it.
And that sort of makes sense because the Podlings and the Gelflings are both small people.
What about a yearling? Like that's an actual term, you know?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's where I'm coming from because I think about something childlike a little bit.
I think that's the proper context. I'm with you there. So the Podlings. But I guess I was trying to think of things I wanted to talk about with The Dark Crystal because it is kind of a child's tale and the story's fairly simple. It's like a prophecy and prophecies are a little I always find them a little unsatisfying, you know, as sort of the template for a story because it's a prophecy, then the prophecy has to come true, right? I mean, it's sort of ridiculous to
it's a bit of an excuse to drive a storyline because you can always go, well, it had to happen, so the story has to continue because it's prophesized. It's a little bit of a weak way to drive a story. Characters aren't motivated by natural needs or desires. I mean, you even see this here in the movie where Jen can't figure out what he's supposed to do, and he just keeps falling back on, well, I guess I should do what the prophecy tells me to do.
Right.
For no other reason than that's the reason he's supposed to do it.
Well, there's always the coincidence of prophecy, too, like Cortez and the Aztecs, where he showed up. They assumed he was Quetzalcoatl returned as per the prophecy. And, you know, Quetzalcoatl would basically wreak havoc upon the Aztecs and annihilate them. And then as a result, Cortez goes and does that. So, you know.
Well, there's always the great prophecy. I prophesize that in the future, at some undetermined time, there will be change.
Yeah, right.
Well, not exactly an all-seeing prophecy.
Well, this prophecy is pretty specific. The Skeksis' reign of the world will end, and the Gelfling will have caused it. I mean, that seems pretty strange.
Well, that's the whole part of good prophecy. An actual prophecy seems like coincidence because it comes from actual foresight. So if you could actually see the movie and see the future and talk about it, your predictions would seem amazingly coincidental because somehow things would just happen to come to be to match what you had foretold.
Well, it's sort of the Nostradamus thing, right? He just basically spouted a bunch of vague bullshit back in the 17th century. And, you know, you always see shapes in the clouds when you want to. So,
well, you're talking about actual prophesizing that's done in the real world. I'm more talking about actual prophecy in the fantasy world.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's prophecy that is in fact actually prophecy. In this fantasy world,
you've read a lot more, I think, fantasy. I'd call it high fantasy than me. You know, your sword and sorcery kind of stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
No, you don't read that now. But was there like the prophecy trope? Was that pretty road hard and put away wet in that genre?
You know, I have a trouble remembering a lot of those books. But yeah, I mean, there was often a prophecy element. And sometimes it seems like mostly they played it more like you would expect prophecies. They were rather vague and yeah. open-ended. So, you know, somebody, the main character appears in some land and he looks vaguely like somebody was prophesized to bring some sort of thing into existence. And through the 10 book series that happens to come true right. in the end. And
well,
of course, the main hero is conflicted. He's like, oh, there's no way I'm the hero, or maybe I am the hero. No, I can't be the hero. I don't want to be the hero.
Yeah.
And they finally accept that I'm the hero.
Yeah, right. You're it. Yeah. No, I get the whole prophecy vagueness thing. Although I must say, I myself prophesized that there would be no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I'm just saying, I nailed it. It wasn't even vague. I didn't even. I'm just saying, I'm a seer. I'm a modern seer.
Well, I know. Well, look, I don't want to get in an argument with all your acolytes. All right, so I'm just going to leave it right there. I don't want to get
in
trouble.
And back in 2007, I was like thinking, you know what? I think house prices got to come down. Just saying. I'm just saying, putting it out there. I didn't have a percentage.
You've looked on the world with your cold, hard, robot-like logic. Instead of going, I need to get a house right now, no matter what the terms of the loan may be.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you weren't possessed by the crowd. There was a quote, and I'm going to find it. I think it was by... Oh, man, it's late Friday night and my memory fails me. But it was something about the pessimist. And I'm going to find it here. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to drag it all down, but I think it's kind of fun.
Things are getting so well. While you're looking it up, I'm going to mention one thing. And you go ahead and keep looking it up.
Okay.
I like to mention in movies when I see a new word or a word I'm not familiar with, sort of the SAT type word. And this time in this movie, the word I was not familiar with was Harridan, which is Harridan. It was actually in the opening dialogue. The new emperor of the Skeksis calls Agra the Harridan.
Okay.
And
yes.
Harridan, it means a bossy old woman.
Oh, I was okay. I just called her Agra Winfrey. I don't know. I like
her name was Agra, but he calls her a Harridan, which is an actual
Harridan, which is a prattling old woman. That is that the definition?
Yeah. Do you knew that? I'd never heard.
No,
that
no, no. Before. I was just. That's how bad my memory is. I had to basically refresh there. So
you were supposed to be looking up whatever the hell you were trying to look up.
I know. I've been sidetracked.
I was doing some fill here.
Here it is. It's George Bernard Shaw, the famous writer of, I guess, I forget what century, 18th or 17th. Here it is. The power of accurate observation is commonly called cynicism by those who have not got it. I think you liked that on my Facebook post. But anyway, that's not really a prophecy thing. But the power of accurate observation, I think, is a little bit, you know, a little bit of sort of seer foresight type of exercise is commonly called cynicism by those who have not got it. You know, I like to elevate it a little bit and call it the Cassandra complex. You know the truth, but everybody else doesn't believe you or thinks you're an idiot. So,
well, it's only knowing the truth is only really useful when you can make some money on it.
Yeah, I can't. I couldn't make any money. Actually, I did make a little bit of money. I bought gold back in 2004. And I sold it right at the peak. When Glenn Beck was up there hawking it on his shitty, crazy Fox News conspiracy show, I was like, it is time to sell gold at this point, you know, when he's
when
he's basically
buying it.
When he's swindling old people to go buy it, I was like, yeah, it's time to go find something else.
I keep thinking about our 401ks. Everybody's buying them. So they're obviously going to be a bad investment.
Well, it's a little different. All right.
I don't know about that. That's my prediction. Mark prophesizes that everybody's 401k will be useless when they're 70 years old.
Well, you're probably right. I don't like to think about that.
I probably shouldn't be putting my 20% of my income into it.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about puppets for a bit. I've been pondering puppets kind of all day. This movie had no humans in it. It was all puppeteering.
Well, I mean, does puppeteering, is that, I think you're using it rather broadly here. They're using a series of different techniques to animate dolls or models, right? They're using puppeteering. They're using wires. What's that called?
Well, there's marionettes.
I mean, yeah, they're using marionette type. And they're also using whole suits quite a bit in this movie.
Right. I you know, which I guess is not what we would think. I mean, that's like calling, you know, the alien in the film Alien a puppet. It's just a guy in a suit, you know.
We're using a rather broad sort of non-standard definition of puppetry.
I guess you're right. I mean, there's some things in here that definitely, I guess, fall under the traditional sort of movie-making costume. I guess I would argue like kind of the full body suits, like the Skeksis or the Mystics.
The Skeksis, but I don't think they're always full body suits. You know, I wonder if they play with perspective a little bit in this movie, because you can certainly see where some of the Skeksis or the Garthams or the Stilt Walkers, is that what they called them?
I think where they're like the Striders or something like that. I forget.
It's Striders, that's right. And the Mystics were full body suits, but there's other times where they're doing fine facial shots, which I'm sure that's puppetry. We added with some marionette work with the arms.
Well, a lot of those sort of snarls of the Skeksis, you know, the eyeballs, the jaw, the tongue, all that kind of stuff, that was done with typical RC activation, you know, so you have radio controls in there and stuff. Yeah, radio control type stuff.
I mean, a lot of these creatures, I mean, almost the most of the full-size creatures and aren't the small ones, they're all done sort of like Big Bird.
Yeah, like Big Bird. That's kind of a good
It's a guy with his arm up in the air, control, like moving the head around, and his feet are the feet of the creature. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great. I fucking love, God, the art style, just awesome in this movie. I hadn't seen it till today.
Oh, are you serious? You haven't seen The Dark Crystal
I've never
before?
Seen this movie. Never seen any of it. I was totally unfamiliar. I didn't even know it existed.
Oh, really?
It really blew me away. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's
movie
fun.
Really blew me away.
Just
great to watch. I really want to go watch this movie again. Like on the big, I watched it on my laptop.
Yeah.
And I really want to get my home theater, plug it into my home theater and watch it there. I think it'd really be worth it. Maybe you can get a Blu-ray of it if there's a good transfer.
I think there is. It's a fun movie. I mean, I saw it in the theater with my parent. My dad, I think, took me to see it. And so it's been in, and there hasn't really been a movie like it that's come out that's been so, I guess, dominated by, there's no human actors. You're always kind of, you know, either go the Pixar route or animation route. And this isn't animation. This is puppetry and live action. Or you mix human beings in with the puppets, kind of like the Muppet movies that we've sort of been, handed for the past, I don't know, interim, if you will, from 1982 till now. So it's sort of unique in that regard. I can't think of a movie that mimics it or even comes close to its scope. And I'm not sure why the movie was successful.
I think that it needed some genius behind it. It needed Frank Oz. It needed Jim Henson to really exist.
Right. And it needed some, I mean, I think this is back when filmmaking was a little bit more bold. I don't know if it's due to budget inflation. Will was telling me that it's so bad in Hollywood right now that they literally employ statisticians to run through every scene in these big budget movies to compare them to other big budget movies and then make edits based on that. It's how bad it's gotten. Oh, it's terrible.
Look, when you're putting out, like, just think about this Iron Man 3 movie that I'm not going
not
to
see it. Fuck it.
But,
not seeing it.
But just think that you put up $250 million probably to produce it when you consider
easy.
Advertising and everything.
Oh, easy.
Easy.
Yeah.
And you stand to make $1 billion. You probably hire a few bean counters to try to hedge your bets a little bit on how you make it.
Yeah. Well, what I'm worried about now is almost critic inflation, like grade inflation. Like, we're so numbed by shitty, I would call it genre film. I don't know of any other way to put it. You know, popcorn movie film. That at some point we're going to start thinking bad movies are good, and then that's going to be scary. And maybe that's why it's good to go back, like, back in mind some of our film heritage to sort of refresh what we think is a good film and what we know is a bad film. You know, compare things to the old. And that kind of goes against a lot of what I've said, but I think nowadays it's almost essential. You need some kind of compass to know that you're watching shit on the big screen because it's so full of shit these days, you know. So,
well, I guess, you know, you always got to make sure that you also try to think about these movies make a lot of money, which means there's a lot of eyeballs watching them. So you got to, I mean, there's the idea of popularity and the idea of good film. And I don't think we should probably certainly think that if a movie's popular, there's an element of it that is good. And that,
Iron Man is the first movie was extremely enjoyable. I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I thought Favreau did a good job. I thought Robert Downey Jr. cast as Iron Man or Tony Stark was excellent. I thought that was a good choice, and I think it made for a good comic book movie. Although it doesn't take much to rise above the dreck of a comic book film these days. So,
well, we're talking about the big budget stuff. I just don't think we should get too pessimistic. I think if anything, we're in a golden age of film because you can make a film for very little money now.
That's
a good looking film.
And I've
you
seen
can't
some.
Make a good looking sci-fi film necessarily, but you can make a good little comedy, a good little drama.
I don't
act.
Know. IO9 has been putting a lot of, I would almost call them Kickstarter movies, up. And they look pretty good. The acting's really bad and the direction's kind of poor. But it's not the fault of the effects or, you know, things don't look chintzy. They look actually pretty sleek. It's just there's some issues with, I guess, fundamental filmmaking that kind of drag it back.
I guess I'm just not pessimistic about films. Is the thing.
Good.
I remember I was watching the Making of Apocalypse Now doc that came on the DVD we got some time ago. And the director was sitting there and he's talking about filmmaking. He was just lamenting the technical aspects of filmmaking and the way it burned through money. The film, all the equipment, getting all the light right. And he was imagining a future where you would just take something and just point it at your subject and film it. Where you could film things without all the huge technical aspects behind it. And he says whenever that time comes, it'll be the purest time of filmmaking. Where it's no longer a technical pursuit, it's strictly an artistic pursuit. And I think we're finally getting to that point.
But do you think you could make a movie like The Dark Crystal now? I don't think you could at all. It would never take flight, it would be done.
I don't know. I mean, there's been quite a bit done with, I mean, the thing that I think is similar, just thinking about this movie, is some of the movies that have been done in miniature, like Nightmare Before Christmas and The Ilk.
Sure. Yeah, there is.
It has a similar feeling to this. I mean, it's a totally different technique, but I think the result is sort of similar. It's a physical thing that's manipulated. So I think its spirit lives on in some forms. Just not
maybe
in this
right
particular
there.
Puppetry type form, which I guess was never really repeated. You see it in some aspects. The animations of like the Skeksis and the Mystics reminded me a lot of the recent Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy film adaptation that was done a few years ago.
Yeah, I saw that.
I forget the name of the creatures, but there's sort of the.
Accountants of
the universe. And they have a very similar, they're probably animated in the same way. It wasn't CG. They were guys in big suits lumbering around.
Right.
And it reminded me of that. And I don't know. There's something about that lumbering man in a suit.
Well,
I just find really appealing.
Back to the whole puppetry thing. When you watch in this movie, you know you're watching puppets. It's obviously, you know, everything but the strings you're seeing in the film.
Well, you know, while I like the Skeksis and the Mystics, and I really liked Agra quite a bit, how she was animated, sort of like
it's like a little ogress.
Yeah. I thought it was really pleasant. I just loved the way she was animated. The way she sat down was really impressive. But I didn't really like the Gelflings. I didn't think they were animated as well as the other characters.
Which is sort of
too bad because they're like the main characters. They reminded me a little bit of the Team America movie.
Now, there was a good puppet. I don't know. Did you ever watch those old Thunderbird films? I used to.
Yeah, they reminded me because, Team America was done in homage to the old Thunderbird style. And the Gelflings, Jen and Kira, reminded me a lot of them.
Yeah, except for I think Thunderbirds were like a third scale or something. They were done a little bit smaller, but I almost forgive the film that it's you know, the human character, if you will. It needed a little bit of something. The thing is, it's fine.
I mean, you get used to it, but it's a little jarring at first, especially when the first time you see him, he's naked.
Well, the dead eyes. I think, you know, when you see a human-like character, you know, you hit this uncanny valley.
Yeah, it's weird. It's sort of the non-computerized uncanny valley.
Right. And you know, for people who aren't aware, uncanny valley is, I forget, it's a something that a Japanese roboticist theorized. I'm going to get it totally wrong. And it's this point that there's this valley. Like, you can deal with sort of anthropomorphic human beings that are caricatures, kind of similar to Pixar type of human beings. You know, they're just sort of these cartoonish versions of humans. But then when you get a little too close to human without actually being fully, you know, a mimic, you hit this zombie-like state called the uncanny valley, where the human beings are, where you as a human being are sort of revolted by what you're seeing. And it's like the zombie effect. And so with this, you get kind of, you know, you can forgive it because they're not really humans. They're Gelflings and they have odd features, but they're supposed to be the humans and their eyes freak you out. I mean, they're kind of pitch black, aren't they? They don't really work with pupils or anything like that.
A little bit. I only found it disturbing right at the beginning. By the time Kira comes along, I accept them for the way they're animated. And I was moved by their scenes near the end. So I got past it, but it's a little weird at first.
But yeah, it's strange. Well, and back to the whole thing about puppetry. I think I was bored last night, so I read some Conan the Barbarian, Savage Sword of Conan. I have a bunch of I guess compilations of the old comic book, and I'm not a big comic guy, but I was reading through, you know, the comic, and I've always had a problem with comics because it's a literary form, yet they provide you visuals, yet the visuals aren't adequate enough to erase any sort of need for suspension and disbelief or more imagination to sort of flesh out the picture that you're seeing. But it's, I was thinking about the puppets and I was sort of giving it a lot more, I guess, credit. You know, it gives you suspension and disbelief is sort of a, I don't know, it's a gray kind of device that we use for storytelling. And if you can kind of buy into it, it sort of allows you to get more into the story. And that's kind of what I was doing reading Conan last night. I was getting more into the story, and I would kind of almost put a movie into my mind based on some of the pictures that I was seeing. I wasn't substituting things directly. And so with puppetry, I think you're doing a little of that. You're doing a little...
I think you're doing a lot of that.
You're kind of making a movie within a movie. You're allowing... your imagination to fill out the kind of, I guess, dead spots in the actual film media that you're watching.
Well, I think so much, you can call them dead spots, but the limit of the media, there's only so much expression they could put in the Skeksis' eyes. But in the end, you sort of, you take the little cues that Jim Henson's giving you, and you read the proper emotions into it. It's sort of a, there's a different way you read puppets. They're a little bit like old-time movies where they sort of overact a little bit, and they project their movements. And it's a little unsettling at first, but this movie, I don't know, I got right into it after about 20 minutes or so, where you sort of accept these exaggerated movements and see them almost more subtly, like you would see them in a person in a drama.
And to me, it added a whole level of eeriness to the world that was being created. This planet is definitely not sort of a mirror of our world. It's not like, it's not like Middle Earth or Westeros of Game of Thrones. There's like three suns, you know.
Yeah, it's really weird. How about that fucking amazing set piece at Agra's lab, where it's supposedly showing the planetary and sun system, and it's just circles within circles.
What are those called? I mean, I know they're called,
I forget what those planetary dioramas are called. If there's an actual term for them, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah, but hers is like a crazy kind of acid trip, fantastic freak out version of it. Where
it's a pretty impressive scale. And just the look of it, I mean, whoever built that really knew what the fuck they were doing, because it was pretty big.
It was like a clockwork. I mean, it had to work for the film. It couldn't be, maybe it was some guy twisting a big wheel at the bottom underneath the
floor. I'm sure it probably was, but it just really looked really great. I was really
And it was kind of ominous. Like it was, sort of a, like a otherworldly difference engine that was calculating something that, was foretelling doom. But it just, I don't know, it was great. It was just,
I think that's that moment when he ends up in Agra's mountaintop lab is when I really fell in love with the movie.
Oh, really? Was it Agra that did it? You seem to be kind of taken by Agra.
I thought that was probably the best character in the film.
It added some needed comic relief. It did that, but
be quite honest with you, the other fault of the film is probably some of the voice acting is not that great, and Agra's is one of the better of the voice actors.
Actually, Frank Oz was going to do it, and I guess his initial takes at Agra sounded a ton like old Yoda, and I guess it just seemed weird for the female character that they were trying to create with Agra. So they abandoned him, and I think they went to some other voice actor. I don't know who it is, but...
Jen, the person who voice acted Jen, did a very good job. And that's the only thing that really grated on me. I sort of got used to it near the end, but I think that could have been a little better if we're going to nitpick a little bit.
We can nitpick. I mean, that's kind of all we got to nitpick. There's really no acting per se. There's voice acting like a animated film. Agra was probably the most complete, well-furnished, fleshed-out character. Chamberlain was all right.
With his sort of squeaky sounds he made.
He sounds like our dog Ted. I don't know. You know Ted. Ted is... he constantly whines because he's food motivated. And so, if you listen close to him, like when he's being quiet, he whines, but it's almost inaudibly. He's constantly whining, but it's just you have to turn the volume up on him, like depending upon his needs to hear it. So, like when he needs to go out, the whine comes up to like volume 10, or when he is hungry, but the whine is always there. It's kind of funny. Like, so you listen to him and you hear it and it's like a whispering whine, like Chamberlain's always whining.
Well, it's interesting. The amount of effort and time they put into creating the different Skeksis. And they actually name them in the credits, like the Armand and the Chemist. But they put very little. Actually, the Mystics all seem to be identical.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of differentiation.
Well, it almost seems like we don't get to know them. And I think they actually do name them separately, too. But they just don't seem that different. I wonder if the movie's trying to say something about the negative aspects of individualism.
There's a whole basis, a metaphysical basis for this film. And, of course, I can't find it in all the crap I'm looking at right now.
I mean, the way the movie resolves itself, you have a feeling there's some sort of high order of beings that try to do something. 1,000 years in the past, they tried something out, and they actually say it was because of their own, smugness or their own feelings of superiority, and as a result, it broke this crystal and sort of an age of darkness was brought across the land.
Could it have been like a time bandits where this supreme being creates evil as an experiment?
I don't think so. I mean, I think these beings, they had some sort of plan that it required this alignment of the sun, that suns that only happens every 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And they fucked it up, basically. And they had to wait 1,000 years for it to get unfucked. And I think this whole prophecy thing was sort of like maybe their backup plan, just in case something went wrong, which it wasn't going to happen, but it ended up going wrong. And it took 1,000 years for the wrong to be righted. Isn't that the general idea of the film?
Yeah, like you say, it's sort of this experiment that these sort of, I guess, rulers of this world took upon themselves
in their arrogance. And the way they split, it seems like the two sides of these, all-knowing or omnipotent beings are split, the bad and the good.
Right.
And it's sort of split with the selfish and the individualistic with the natural holistic persons.
Right.
So yeah, the movie's trying to say something about...
The Skeksis are hedonists. They're gluttons.
They are, and they're also individual. I'm just wondering... It seems like, and they're all sort of out for themselves. You see the way that the old emperor passes.
I think you've discovered it, man. This is like a capitalist versus communist morality play. That's what this is.
And it's saying that capitalism's bad and communism's good.
Fuck yeah. I'm
no wonder kids walked out. They knew inherently that was the wrong thing.
They're like, this is the Reagan era. I'm not listening to this bullshit. Come on, Dad.
Mommy,
we're leaving.
Marxism's bad, isn't it? Yes, it is, honey.
We're fucking not sitting around for more of Henson's communist garble. We're out of this movie. Exactly.
But I guess that's sort of the point of it. And the dark crystal becomes the crystal of truth. Right at the end,
yeah, it becomes the crystal of truth, and it turns like an opaque white, you know, that shines and all that good stuff. So, there's. I'm trying to find the what the metaphysical basis is in my notes, but I'm unable to find it. So,
another set piece that I really enjoyed from this film is the setup where the slave master Skeksis would drain life essence beings using the power of the dark crystal.
Is that not the most terrifying part of this film? I think that's what would freak kids out the most.
Amazing. Seeing those podlings get the life essence drained from them, it's just amazing.
And when I was a kid watching that, I was a little sadistic. I was like, hey, let's see what happens when we suck the life out of those little weird things, you know. And then as they're getting it and as they're turning into zombies, there's kind of a weird sadistic, I don't know, I was getting a little sadistic enjoyment out of it. And I don't know why. I don't know if it was like, I viewed them more as troll dolls that I was kind of, you know, like, shooting with BB guns in my backyard or something.
Well,
I don't know.
You know, there's something to be said. There's something weird about children. I have some memories of where the idea is where you're trying to sort of come to understand what is life and death as a child. Nobody really explains it to you. So sometimes you end up experimenting with those ideas on lower beings. I don't know if you ever tortured any animals as a kid or saw it happen.
No. I think, I'm not a serial killer now, so I didn't take it to the next level. I remember
one time hanging out with some friends, and there was a salamander, and they decided they wanted to smash it with a rock against another rock. So it was just sitting on a rock. And so these friends of mine took a rock, and we must have been like 7, and they took a rock and smashed the salamander, and he was all squished and dead. And I always find that image really fascinating. It's like one of those early memories. And I guess I've always thought about that, you know, coming to realize that that's a wrong act. That you shouldn't just
take
a life, even of a lower being, for no reason. But as a child, you sort of have to experience that. And that experience comes at the cost of a lower being.
My friend Jeff Turk, when I was in grade school, he like lassoed, or he took like a rope and he made a noose or something, and he tied it around like a gardener snake's head, and then he like whipped it into a fence post and it decapitated it or something. And yeah, it was the same kind of thing you're describing, you know, where it's just some bizarre power experiment by children to like sort of, I don't know, understand their omnipotence in the world. It is twisted.
I think every child really needs that experience. And
maybe
it depends on whether you go, hey, I really like smashing salamanders or breaking heads off garter snakes, and you keep doing it. Then maybe that's a path you should probably be a little worried if you went down.
So as a kid, maybe that was a vicarious satisfaction watching the podlings get, you know, turned into zombies there by having their essences drained.
It's the same satisfaction you get from lobotomizing hookers.
Right? Wow, man, you're taking them to the next level. I just steal their
kidneys. I'm not talking about me here.
All right, okay. Anyway, but frightening nonetheless, it was still a disturbing scene because, for starters, it makes no biological sense in our world. You know, you're like, what the fuck are they doing? Could something do that to me?
Way their eyes were open and they just couldn't stop staring into the reflection of the dark crystal.
Yeah, like, what are they seeing? Like, it's like hypnotizing them. Why are they powerless to stop it? You know, and then their faces drain away. Yeah, it's pretty creepy. I mean, this is a kid's movie, and that scene right there is terrifying and unexplainable by a parent. There's no way you could go, well, see, when, you know, there's, I don't know, it's just...
When a man and a crystal really love each other.
That's right. Can suck your living essence right out of you, like your mother does to me. You know, I don't know.
my precious bodily fluids.
Yeah.
There's another scene that involves the crystal that I thought was really amazing. It's right near the end of the movie when... The crystal is healed, or it's in the process of healing, and right at the end, you always see the mystics slowly marching to the tower over the course of the film, and
fun, by the way. I liked that, and I liked how when the Skeksis fell into the pit of the crystal, the other mystic just flashed out of existence, and then the mystics kind of stopped for a second, and they're like, oh, okay, and then they keep moving.
Well, it is interesting that you can see that the mystics and the Skeksis are sort of each other's antiparticle in a certain sense.
Right, right.
They're sort of an entangled pair of beings. But at the very end, where they finally annihilate each other and turn back into their true form before they were split by the apocalyptic events 1,000 years earlier. Right at the very end, just as the crystal's being healed, the mystics walk in, position themselves perfectly around the crystal, and the Skeksis are just sort of running around, scared to death.
They're not even paying attention.
And then all of a sudden, they just happen to run to the exact correct position themselves, where they can all be caught up in the beam. It's beautiful. There's sort of this, there's this chaos of movement in the crystal room, and then all of a sudden it's ordered.
Yeah.
When you're watching the movie, it's just a chaos of movement, and all of a sudden order comes out of it. And it's just a, it's just really magical. Really nicely choreographed.
Yeah, it's a intriguing bit of causality that you know, almost like you throw a ball into the air and it comes back down. It's like it configures exactly into the minimum potential energy configuration that it started out with, which is how these beings originated, and then that's how they return. You know,
yeah. It is pretty interesting. It's almost like sort of some of the beauty with, you know, particles coming into existence and then going back out of existence. I don't know. There's just a lovely dance about it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's there's a lot of cool things about this movie. I guess one thing I liked, and I was watching this, is, and I hate to keep bringing up James Cameron, but I was thinking of, I'm going to find the name of this planet. God damn it. The planet that they're all on, it's named at some point. I can't remember it. I'm doing a disservice by not remembering it. But this planet of the Dark Crystal and Pandora, and I was thinking, which visual world do I like better? And I was like, I'll fucking take this world over Pandora any day. And
there were a lot of sort of, I could call them echoes of Pandora. They're only echoes because I saw Pandora first. But yeah, the Pandora totally ripped off a lot of the ideas.
Well, and I was just thinking, like, there was such care taken with the fauna and the flora of this planet that it's just, like, there's layers of everything's moving, especially in the swamp where you get, you know, like there's that weird submerged fish toad thing that lifts.
Oh, after Jen runs in the fizz gig, right?
Yeah. And just like everything. And it's different. It's not necessarily an extrapolation of, you know, shit we see on Earth. It's like a mix of undersea, like an undersea jungle almost.
There's an endless well of creativity in this film. You can just, you feel like you could fall into this world forever.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just fun. And like, you know, when Jen's going up the mountain towards Agra's and you get like these weird mesas, they look like they've been dripped like sandcastles onto the side of a hill. And, you know, it's kind of like maybe Zion or Bridges National Park in Utah, but it's not. And then there's those weird anemone things that are all hanging out, and as he goes by, they kind of roll back into their caves. And I'm just like, that's just crazy, fantastic, cool. I, you know, to think of that and to incorporate that and make it work visually, I don't know. It just kind of, yeah, made me just a little bit more suspicious that I think James Cameron's a hack when it comes to the whole Pandora thing.
Well, you know, we talked about James Cameron before. He's got a little more of a simpler outlook. He's a guy who gets stuff done, but he's more of a technician. He's not just a pure maniac of creativity like Henson and Oz are.
Yeah, I didn't give them enough credit in the day. I kind of feel bad about that. I mean, I think, you know, despite Henson's shortcomings, i.e., you know, being a Christian Scientist and dying because of it, you know, his mind is just with the Muppets, the world that he could create, you know, not just Sesame Street or, you know, a Muppet movie, but this world is, I think, maybe more significant than people realize.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I'm really glad I saw this movie. I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
I'm glad you liked it. I didn't know you hadn't watched it, so I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Somehow I just totally missed it. I don't even know if Ebert reviewed this, but let's go check. All right. Well, Ebert, this is a strange Ebert review, since it's actually not on his website. I found it in a December 27th issue of the Spokane Chronicle.
Spokanistan.
And I don't know why. Maybe he was doing some work on the side. But the title is Muppet Charm is Missing in the Dark Crystal. So I'll just read his first paragraph here, give you an idea where he's coming from. There's no star rating on this particular movie. You've got to hand it to Jim Henson and Frank Oz. First, they enchanted a generation of kids with the Muppets. Now they're ready to scare the pants off them with the Skeksis, the Mystics, and not least the Gartham.
A little bit.
So I thought that was a pretty funny way to
open it. Yeah, a little bit there. Yeah.
He says, there is nothing charming about most of the characters in this movie. They are hairy, smelly, cadaverous, loathsome, evil, cannibalistic, vindictive, slimy, mean-spirited, dripping, scaling, unkempt, and hateful. But charming they are not. I'm not sure if that's really that seems more of like a compliment than a...
He's just describing the Skeksis. He's not describing everything.
Yeah, the
Skeksis
are that. That's what they're supposed to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
He says that the Gelflings look related to those solemn children with gigantic tearful eyes that you find in paintings in retail shops.
I don't know what he's talking about. What's it called? Precious Moments, I think, which were like a porcelain doll collection. Doe-eyed kids.
Yeah, I think he's talking about that. Maybe I thought there was little creatures in some of Thomas Kincaid's work, The Artist of Light, that sort of looked like that.
The Artist of Light. Is that the guy who does that like really cheesy fantasy shit with
He sort of does like warm paintings of like sort of cottages and natural scenes, sort of like that. I don't know. Some people eat him up. I think he was just sort of a hack artist that was able to turn some coin. Anyways, I mean, be quite honest with it. It's a pretty fair jab at the character design of the Gelflings. It's not the strongest part of the movie.
No, it's not. We already commented on that.
I can't knock him too hard for that. Rather pointed jab. He says, he's talking about, sort of the storyline, which he's not too crazy about, but he says the quest was designed and executed by some of the best special effects people in the business, which is true. And then he goes on to talk about some of the amazing sights created by these people, which we talked about. But he says the high point in animation is probably reached during the banquet scene, which I thought was pretty amazing. He says, I don't know if you had any thoughts about that banquet scene.
We didn't talk about it at all. It was a nice scene that sort of, I guess, portrayed the hedonism of the Skeksis, as it's kind of epitomizing their loathsome evilness. And their appetite for living things was... And also the abuse that they put upon the podlings as they're, wheeling their food into the dining chamber.
So. There's only one thought that I had in my mind. I saw a reflection of us here in the United States in the first world where we lounge away our time on the backs of the poor of the world.
Yeah, that's Henson. For you,
I think it's a pretty valid point.
This is anyway. Go ahead. Sorry, I was gonna.
Yeah,
never mind.
Yeah. Well, anyways, that's what came to my mind. I think that's maybe what Henson was going after. Anyways, he says the Dark Crystal is a labor of love, and he salutes it for that. But he says there's two problems with it that make it problematic as a piece of family entertainment. First, he says many of the scenes last too long because the special effects are lingered over, and I'm glad it lingers over the special effects.
Yeah, but what was he talking about there?
He's criticizing it from a family entertainment standpoint, strictly, and I think they're not going to really appreciate the work and the love of miniature and puppetry. So, in that sense, it doesn't make a good... Kids have very simple tastes, like in food. They like macaroni and cheese,
Right.
In movies, they like some nice action. and some neat characters, and that's about all they
care every about. Kid I've run across, they can't appreciate a good bottle of scotch. You know, I don't know what's up with that. And I'm like,
as
really?
As much scotch as I force kids to drink, they still don't like
it. I'm like, can't you taste the peat and the complexity of the aging and the casking? The fuck's always, wrong with you?
They always go for the Boone's Farm.
What's wrong with fucking kids these days?
No, kids anyway. have a very simple palate, and I think they have a sort of a simple entertainment. I mean, you know, your brain's still forming. It takes a while to see the nuance and things. So I can't fault them there with that point. And he says any kid, the second problem is any kid younger than 10 is probably going to lose some sleep after seeing the horrendous creatures in this film, this is just not a kid's movie. If you take it as that, you can't, I mean, I wonder, so if you're bringing your kids to it, it's not really a great kids film.
And that's why I saw parents walk out with their kids. When I was a kid watching this movie, it, I think, took them by surprise. And, you know, it's weird what sets kids off. I'm sure I'll find out soon, but,
Well, the thing is, the problem with this review from Ebert, it's a fair review, it's a reasonable review, but it's, for a movie with so much imagination, this review has no imagination in it.
Well, to compare
Ebert does this, he phoned this one in, he didn't fucking use his imagination in the review, he didn't, I don't know what it was, it's a short-sighted review.
Well, to compare it to the Muppet Saga, I think is a disservice. It's totally outside that. It's in no way should be compared to Miss Piggy or Kermit or any of that shit. It's outside that, in my opinion. You know, it deserves a little better.
Yeah, it's just a weak review. We've seen plenty of these from Ebert. He's like just like any other person. He wrote this one in, which is maybe why it's not even included on his website.
Could be. Yeah,
it's probably a garbage review that they threw away.
Interesting, though, here in the Spokane Chronicle, December 27, 1982. I'm looking over here. What's in theaters?
And this, what was in theaters?
Let's see. Playing at Fox 1, we have The Dark Crystal at 5:45, 7:45, and 9:45. Fox 2 is playing E.T., The Extraterrestrial, at 5:45.
Whoa, it went up against E.T.? Holy shit.
And for the date movie, if you got a date and you want to take her out for a little Christmas break treat, Officer and Gentleman's playing at Fox 3, 5:30.
Oh, man, this is pre-AIDS. oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm looking here. North Division 6, which is the other set of theaters in Spokane metropolitan area, is playing a little bit more adult. Themed films, 6 weeks. Oh, no, I'm thinking of 9.5 weeks. The fuck was 6 weeks? I don't even
know. How about Me and the Bros? After we had done, doing Brody's, doing donuts in our Gremlin. What do we go see? We need some
I think you want to load up on some Thunderbird and hit the 9:50 showing of Airplane 2, the sequel. I think that's
Man, I think we're going to smoke a spliff.
North Division 6-5 there. All right. And
I think we might be a little late for these showings.
Yeah, and if you gotta see Dustin Hoffman, Tootsie's Plan at the State at 5:45, and 10:50. Or 10:05.
Oh, Tootsie, that's a great film. We really got to review that one sometime. Maybe I'll make that one my favorite pick.
All right,
next time. That's a great film.
Yeah, why don't you let's maybe reconsider that. Now, this is funny.
Well, don't like Tootsie?
Oh, I've never watched it, to be honest. Oh, so
you're in for a real treat if we review Tootsie. It's a really good film.
All right. So anyway,
it's sort of amazing.
All right. I haven't seen it. Okay. Point well taken. Let's see. Another thing about The Dark Crystal, again, it makes me lament my inability to enjoy Washington State's newfound freedom of legal recreational marijuana use.
You can't buy it yet.
When you can buy it. I think the rules just came out today. Looks fantastic, man. You just fucking roll down to your neighborhood weed shop and buy yourself a brownie for, you know, market price, and go home and pop in a DVD of The Dark Crystal. Evening is yours. The bliss of being a young man these days, I can't even imagine. But
I think it's something that's finally going to be able to get me through that commute home at night. I think I can do it high.
Can do it high. Just don't do it loaded. That's right. Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, I was thinking about that. And, you know, that this...
I'm going to get you so high, man. You're going to lose your shit.
I don't even want to know what would happen to me. It's been like over a decade since I've tried it. I would...
We're going to black out, man. We're going to black out.
We'd black out, or I'd be in a panic, and you'd be like shoving Xanax down my throat. I don't even know what would be happening. It'd be a fucking mess.
It's going to be a blast. Whatever. I'm going to get so high when the store opens. I'm going to go buy a big bud and just smoke out.
Are you under federal? Blasted. Is your job under federal regulation? Like, could you be drug tested? And could you? You're under state.
No, they're not going to drug test at the UW. Everybody would be fired.
I know. See, I can't because of my job.
I know, and I would never specifically invite you over for dinner and to have a smoke a bowl. That would never happen, and we wouldn't do it.
And you got, hey, man, I got a bowl ready and the Dark Crystal loaded up on the DVD player. What are you going to do?
You're going to get a second hand high.
All right. So, speaking of stoner playgrounds, I think next week, I think your choice falls into that category. I haven't seen this movie since I was a kid.
Me, I haven't seen it for years.
It's, I would say, probably Mel Brooks' finest outing. I can't
think
of one that compares to it.
Yeah, if we're going to do a Mel Brooks film, and I think Mel Brooks, you know, is probably considered, for whatever he's worth, a singular vision for films. He had his own taste in what comedy films should be.
Yeah, well, he's in the farce. I would say he's definitely in the farce realm. I don't know if we're going to like it on a
critical viewing. I don't know how we're going to feel about this film.
Well, I know the humor will be dated. I can almost guarantee that because I don't know when it came out. But
did we even say what it was?
Blazing Saddles. Jesus,
that's all right.
Sorry about it.
It's a classic. I think it's well within our oeuvre for this podcast. And
yeah,
I haven't seen it in years. I enjoyed it a long time ago, but we're gonna have to see how the farce hits us. We've had pretty bad luck with comedies so far.
That's so bad. We'll
see what happens. You
know, work ourselves out of the wet paper bag here and find ourselves a comedy that we all enjoy. And to our listeners, I once again apologize. I'm still coming down from a bad cold, and so a little nasally this go around.
Yeah, it's a weird week. Gene's sick, and I got a rash all over my arm. It's like almost like I got chicken pox. It's the weirdest thing.
Jesus, man. All right.
I'm falling apart.
Don't be spreading that around bus seats. That's all I got to say.
Maybe I've been on the bus a little bit lately.
Got some metro contact.
I swear
dermatitis.
The seat I sat on this morning for the bus smelled just like Febreze, which
that's
made me wonder
sign.
What happened to the seat over the night. Why did they put Febreze on this seat?
Oh, I got to tell a quick story here.
Yeah,
I was at the Gorge. We were watching my friend Scott Ogden and I. And another friend were watching, or we are attending a Who concert. And again, folks, don't go see classic rock. It's just not worth it. It's never like you think. And anyway, we're sitting there at the Gorge, and this drunk couple was in front of us being really obnoxious, just like really obnoxious. Old, like kind of middle-aged drunk couple.
Like doing what obnoxious things?
Oh, just being loud and, you know, people were telling them, hey, can you quiet down or can you knock that off? And they were yelling at him. And the guy was way drunk. He was like stumbling around. Just it was pathetic. He barfs all over like the seats and the floor or the whatever, the cement, you know, it's outside. Barfs everywhere. And we're like, oh, for fuck's sake, you know. And the Gorge, the amphitheater staff come down there and clean it up and, you know, put all the shit on the ground and all that kind of stuff, and they're standing there and everybody's making fun of them because they're a fucking wreck. And anyway, so they like clean it up and they're sitting back down. The guy's like kind of doing that weird junkie nod, you know, I mean, he's just that drunk. And come to find out, they were in the wrong fucking seats for the past 45 minutes because the actual
people
who had those seats come down, and they're like, yeah, these are our seats. And so then they move this fucking shit-faced couple out of their seats to God knows where, and this couple sits down, and they're starting to look around, and you like they get this sense that just something disgusting just happened there, because it's just like the reek of, you know,
that sort of sweet, that oh, they brought cleaner in, yeah.
Yeah, there's like a cloying sort of cleaner odor, and you're just sitting there snickering. You're like, oh my God, if they only knew that that guy had just fucking like barfed, you know, half a pitcher of margarita all over that goddamn seat. It's disgusting. So
yeah, somebody shat their pants in the seat I sat in this morning yesterday.
Lovely.
Pretty disgusting. Yeah. I better burn my pants.
I think that's a good primer for Blazing Saddles. So on that note, until next week.
Some directions.
Another world. Another time. In the age of wonder. Another world. Another time. This land was green and good until the crystal cracked.